All right. Welcome to another episode of the Nui Tech People podcast. On today's episode, we've got Andrei Pinkovsky. Mate, for those of our listeners that don't know who you are, can you give them a bit of an overview of who you are and your backstory to date?
My backstory?
Yeah, what brings us to sitting down today and having a conversation?
Yeah, right. So I guess, look, right now I sit on a number of boards. I advise and consult a number of startups and scale-ups. I don't have a day job anymore. I was CEO or co-CEO and co-founder of a company called Port, P-O-R-T-T.
Yeah.
We did enterprise SaaS, some big contract and procurement management systems for government and enterprise. Sold that last year, stepped away in October, took some time to myself, got a bit bored, started dabbling again, and both in terms of governance and strategy, helping out a few organizations in terms of board roles, as well as advising and consulting.
Mate, reason I'm super interested to have a conversation today, you are a successful startup founder who got to that exit stage, which I guess for a lot of people is the end goal. Some people want to see it through and that be their life's work. Other people want to get to that exit and get out and get the cash. Mm. So really interested to sort of explore that story and see what sort of advice you might be able to give other people who are going on that journey. But how did Port start?
How did Port start? So Port started, myself and an old uni colleague, Chris Holmes.
Yeah.
We were both working in Canberra at the time, consulting, contracting to federal government. Myself in more technical IT roles and Chris in project portfolio management roles. We saw an opportunity to not just be part of these bigger projects, but to lead these big projects. And so we put together a company called Single Cell Consulting at the time. And we brought on some people, mainly as subcontractors, and we pitched and for and won a number of big IT projects. This was mainly in the Microsoft Enterprise stack, so deploying, customizing, developing against SharePoint, Project Server, these sorts of big Microsoft Enterprise systems. So we did that for a few years. We're both originally from Newcastle, met at the uni here, before my wife, who is also from Newcastle, couldn't handle the cold in Canberra anymore.
Yeah.
So we moved back to the coast, to Sydney. I started doing some work with New South Wales Health. Chris was doing some work with Federal Industry at the time, and this work was around strategic contract management. So they were looking, they'd engaged us to build separately, to build these big bespoke enterprise contract management systems. And this is for either high value or high risk contracts. So contracts that need not just contract managers, but supplier managers. They've got inputs and outputs from across the organization. Yeah, so we were building these bespoke systems, and we asked ourselves, why is no one using off-the-shelf software for this? This is back in 2011. And you know, you had your SAP Ariba, you had your Oracle iProcure, a few of these bigger systems, but they weren't really, they were sort of older, a bit clunky, weren't really, localized appropriately for the Australian market. It didn't have a lot of uptake. So we saw a market opportunity there. We pivoted the organization over a number of years it took and effectively built a SaaS product to manage these big procurement contract management processes for organizations. We beat out SAP in competitive tender with New South Wales Health for our first customer, which was very much like eating the elephant. 130,000 staff over the whole state. Chris, my co-founder, became a Rex frequent flyer, traveling everywhere to get this system up. It's an 18-month project, but that was the cornerstone of our company, effectively.
Really interesting point. So I think there's two sides of this going on right now in the market with the rise of AI and different AI products that are out there, right? There's technology there and people can build technology solutions without actually having a problem or having a customer at the end to actually buy these. Great technology. I think it's the same with the App Store, right? Mm. There's thousands of really well-built apps on the App Store. No one uses them. Maybe they didn't get that product market fit right. You've gone in the opposite way. You actually had a problem there. You had customers coming to you and then you built the solution for that problem. Vice versa. Do you think that it sounds like that's part of the key to your success, right?
Oh, look, a big part. And I've seen that quite a lot. And the VCs I've spoken to over the years also really look for that. Look for someone who's felt the pain in the industry, because you're much closer to the problem. You're aware that there's a problem, and you can better capitalize on that. Build it and they will come, which I did multiple times earlier in my career, is not an effective strategy to scale a business.
Yeah, cool. So if you're talking to other people who are looking to be startup founders at the moment, got a great idea or a great product, is it going that MVP route, really testing it with the product market fit? Is that the type of advice you would go with somebody looking to, you know, start out at the moment?
Look, it's hard to give general advice like that because it really depends on the sector and the industry. So B2B, B2E, we could go with more of an MVP and we could take it a bit slower and we could bootstrap. I mean, yes, we had a high margin consultancy business. We could funnel all our profits into R&D, but our average contract size was significant, six figures.
Yeah.
And took, 18 months to implement, at least in the earlier days. Okay. So you had time to sort of time and resources to work through it, and you could build a partnership, a personal partnership with your customers. B2C, very different. A lot of those luxuries go away and you approach it from a different angle. But look, certainly being part of the industry you're trying to change and having a passion for it or an understanding for it is definitely an advantage.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good starting point, right? Mm. Somebody having that or scratching their own itch, having their own problem that they really understand in that industry and then building for that problem.
Absolutely. And then if you've got the passion, if it means something to you, because that's another big part of it. I mean, it's many, many, many days and nights of hard work.
Yeah.
If you don't have the drive or the passion for what you're working on, it's easy.
You mentioned the word bootstrap before. I imagine I do know for a fact that you raised money throughout that process. Mate, can you give us a bit of an overview of what that process looked like? Mm-hmm. Let's start there and then maybe some advice for other people. But as the VC market's really interesting space at the moment in Australia, it's definitely tightened up. Yeah. So there's a lot of companies going through either looking at it, raising a down round and trying to avoid that, extending their runway. But really, let's start with your experience and kind of sort of understand how that played out for you.
Yeah, sure. So big caveat, it's a different time.
Yeah.
Like you alluded to there, back in 2019, we closed our round at the Christmas almost.
But you did bootstrap through your consultancy to start with.
Until then. Yeah. So we took on contract work, project work, and we even had some non-SaaS product related contracts right up until, almost before we sold. We'd scaled it right down, but there were some great customers that had been instrumental to our journey, and we certainly wanted to support them along the way. So we bootstrapped. We had a high margin consultancy business where we could put profit back into R&D. So we definitely had that going for us, which meant we were profitable. We had to be profitable, otherwise could buy savings and houses. We were profitable up until we decided to take money. 2018, we first went out to the capital markets. We had services revenue. Our services revenue was higher than our ARR at the time, proportionally. So we had a lot of questions around, are you really a SaaS company? You're making most of your money on services around your product. That's great, but how scalable is that, et cetera, et cetera. That was probably the big sticking point. We had a few offers. We had some term sheets in front of us, but ultimately we were in a luxurious position of being able to knock those back. And we spent another year effectively getting our business investment ready. And that involved getting the ARR, focusing on ARR. And if anyone's worked in a SaaS business, they know you can productize almost anything. And that's what we really focused on. Getting that subscription revenue up. And we came back a year later and we'd done all the things we said we were going to do. So we closed a $4 million round in late 2019.
Where did that money come from? Are they Australian-based?
Yeah, Australian-based. CVC, Emerging Companies Fund. A couple of guys called Christian and Christian Jensen and Jonathan Pierce. Fantastic guys. Yep. Both sat on our board through COVID. I guess you can really see the mettle of a person when you're going through crises together. I've got nothing but great things to say about those guys and the funds they run. But yeah, the process itself, I mean, it was a pretty standard investment process in that we shopped around and went on the the roadshow, the pitch roadshow, pitching to anybody who would have us, narrowed it down, mutually narrowed down a list around who was interested and who would potentially be a good fit. Everyone talks about getting smart money and the right investors on, and we certainly wanted to do that. But I've since found that's quite difficult to do. Having people put money in and then be engaged in your business in a productive way is not as easy as it sounds. So I think getting someone you can work with is probably the priority, looking back, and what we got out of it. So we went through, we signed a letter of intent and had a period of exclusivity where they ran through whole due diligence process. So certainly it's not just having your story. If you're going for VC, not angel, if you're it's not just having your story and your headline numbers and pitch lined up. It's about having the data behind it, because these guys are professionals.
Oh, dig.
And they will go through everything, through contracts, customer references. It's great. You'll be getting a lot of questions where you're like, oh, okay, hadn't thought of that, or didn't think that would be something that would come up, and then you'd have to go work through it. So having a data room or having data easily accessible is definitely helps the outcome, helps expedite the outcome. So through a whole bunch of DD, and then obviously negotiating a final shareholders agreement and what that would look like and deal before closing and right before COVID hit.
Yeah, right. And did that was your last raise before you got to your exit?
That was our one and only raise. We were looking to raise again for even bigger international expansion at the end of 2021. But that's when we were approached and around acquisition. I mean, we obviously, during those times, you're getting pinged every week by private equity, VC, et cetera, or private equity in particular, sorry, about acquisition. It was heady, frothy days. But we had a couple very serious pieces of interest there, which we followed through and ultimately, exited with one.
Mate, talk us through that little part there, because I think it's an interesting part. A lot of companies, well, not a lot of companies, few get to that point where they've built a solid enough business where they're having those conversations. But what did you consider? What was playing on your mind when that, you know, those offers were coming around an acquisition? I imagine there's an earn out period there. What did that process look like? What's going through your head? Did you always build this to sell?
Yeah, I think to answer the last question first, yes, at the beginning of the journey, it was just a consulting company. So it was a vehicle for us to do interesting projects and to be paid what we were worth. Obviously, I think when you start on a product journey, you know, it's about scale, and it's either it's an exit of one type or another, whether it's a full trade sale and you step away, whether it's an IPO and you bring in a better management team, if that's the way you go, you know, one shape or another, it's some sort of transformation of your business and your role in it. And of course, as soon as we brought on investors, VCs, they're not there for the good times.
No,
maybe they are a little bit, but mainly they're there for the returns for their investors.
Yeah.
So certainly we'd been on that path for a while, and we'd had an ESOP in place, so we were incentivizing and rewarding key staff with options, share options, and without an exit, they're not worth anything. So definitely it was a core strategy.
So if we get to the point where you're successful enough, as you said, you're getting pinged daily, what's going through your mind at that stage? What are the things that are at play when you're going through that process?
You know, an exit, they're all very unique. You know, it could be somebody wants to do a roll-up strategy where they, private equity loves this, where they buy a bunch of companies and smash them together, look for cost synergies, cut a whole lot of people, and revenue synergies where they can cross-sell, et cetera, et cetera. You become part of that, and it's more than likely you've leveled up, but you're on another startup, bigger startup, but you're on another journey then, versus a straight acquisition to a bigger organization where they buy you out in cash or scrip, and you may have an earn-out period.
What did it look like for you with your decision in the end?
So we had a straight trade sale. We were 100% acquired by Advanced, a UK IT group. And look, they'd been a partner of ours for a year or two prior. they'd spoken, they're quite acquisitive, they're private equity backed, had and at the time an M&A team with revenue acquisition targets, and so they're looking to acquire growth. So they're a big company, profitable, with low single digit, or sorry, single digit growth, which is fine, but it's not, you know, setting the world alight in terms of returns for private equity. So they look to get a lot of their high growth from acquisitions.
Yeah.
And we were a high growing company, rule of 40 of 41 or 42. Your listeners are familiar with the rule of 40. It's effectively growth rate plus profitability should add up to effectively 40% somewhere. Yeah. So you can be high growth but low profitability, or mix of both, etc. So we weren't profitable, but we were a high growing business, which is why we're effectively looking for more capital to grow further and expand. And that lined up perfectly for what they were looking at that time, not just in terms of the business, the operations of the business, but the product. The product being the key thing for them strategically. It plugged a perfect hole in their product portfolio. And that's something they could take to their board and their investors and get across the line. So definitely, being able to be a strategic fit for somebody somewhere is going to make that conversation a lot easier.
Yeah, cool. Now, the interesting part you mentioned there, you mentioned the word partner. Back at the start of your story, you built for partners or customers, and mm-hmm. you viewed them type relationships as a partner. You're building with them, working out their problems, taking their money from a consultancy perspective, but also building with a partner. You grew the business. You started working with another partner who ended up being the people that acquired you.
Yep.
Is that deliberate? Obviously, it was deliberate at the start. From the end point with the acquisition, was that a deliberate partnership? Did you see that as potential on the table when you started partnering with them a couple of years out? It's just a really interesting approach, and I think that's a smart approach.
Yeah, look, they weren't shy about saying they'd be very interested in acquiring us if and when the time was right, when they first partnered with us. So that was always on the table. We worked with them as a distribution partner, effectively, channel partner into the UK.
Yep.
So they got a very close look at obviously our product, but then also how you sell it and how it was received in that market there. So that gave them a lot of surety around what exactly they were buying. I guess the only other comment I'd make on that process, how it was made easier with a partner, was effectively that we knew them, we knew the people there, they knew us, and these sorts of deals often come down to interpersonal relationships, particularly during the middle of COVID when this was. So we did the whole deal end to end over video call over Teams. I remember one time with a call with lawyers from all sides, had US, UK, Australia, and I was actually quite sick with COVID at the time, but it was it's just a whole screen of little faces everywhere, everyone talking, and it was definitely an experience.
Yeah, right. Cool. Mate, so you've built a technology, you've built a SaaS company from the ground up, started from a consultancy, scratching your own itch, scratching your customer's itch, seeing an opportunity, building that up. Your role started as a technical person, and you ended up being the CEO of a company that's had a successful exit. What did that transition from a technical, someone who loves playing with technology, good in that technology space, to becoming a CEO? That's what I'm super interested in. The rise as somebody goes through the thing. You did go from the technical, you didn't go into CTO, you went to the CEO.
Yep.
But what did that change look like? Again, was it deliberate to you to not go to the CTO route and really position yourself as a CEO? What did that journey look like for you? Because I think it's a really interesting one. The different skill sets.
Yeah.
Not everyone can play in both spaces. What did it look like for you?
It's a great question. Look, I've always been more on the tech side than on the than on the sales leadership side. I taught myself to code when my uncle gave me his first computer. Oh, sorry, my first computer when I was 15 or so.
Yeah.
Had a few little web companies that I'd set up, and obviously contracting in Canberra, that taught me a lot more of the softer skills, interpersonal skills that would help a lot later on. But it was definitely a journey. It was over 13 years or so that we started Port. Yeah, I started building. I think they're still running my production servers. God help them.
Yeah, right.
Hopefully they'll be decommissioned soon as they move to more modern containers and things. It was very much a journey. I had to learn all the time. I had to be uncomfortable all the time, out of my comfort zone. I hated selling. I still don't like selling, but I had to do it. Especially as you grow and you have more people relying on you, relying on this entity that you've helped bring into life. So no, I think being open to learning all the time, really not skimping on those interpersonal skills, both internally and externally. Certainly, I had my challenges there, and I'm definitely still on the more no nonsense side of things, in terms of interpersonal engagements and leadership there. But it was it was just a trial by fire. You had to do it, or you didn't. And I didn't go to CTO. I'm not brilliant technically. We brought on a brilliant guy called Nigel Castellino, who I think you've met before,
yeah.
who was our head of tech and became our CTO. Couldn't think of a better person.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I was only reading something on, I think it was Sydney Startups the other day. Very, very often in the past, I think it was somebody with an idea or a business idea looking for a technical co-founder. And I think there's a bit of a switch happening at the moment where it was always, the business side, harder, the coding side's the more difficult part.
Mm.
And now with the rise of no-code tools and AI and a few other bits and pieces, we've got some potential technical co-founders looking for somebody who can do the business development. Business development is probably the hard part. That's the hardest part. Management, the rest of it can, we can work on that. But that business development side, really interesting to pair up with those technical skills, right?
Absolutely. If you haven't got sales, you haven't got revenue coming in, what are you doing? So absolutely. And we, Chris and myself filled that BD role as co-founders for the first half or so or more of the business's life before we brought on a brilliant head of growth, Mark Reddy, who like Nigel in the technical space was had incredible experience and skills in the growth.
And so it sounds quite space. Interesting there, right? You and Chris are there building, you're playing multiple roles, get to a certain point in growth, and then you hire a specialist into it from a technical perspective, then you bring in your CTO, then you bring in your head of growth.
Yep.
So that's sort of how you'd recommend other people play. Obviously, as a smaller company, you've got to wear many hats, you've got to do what's necessary until you've got the money to pay for somebody good.
Yeah, that's right. And look, again, it depends on the situation you're in and the market you're servicing, but that's a way that worked for us. It would work for similar businesses in a similar market and similar position. We were growing organically. We didn't have resources to throw at hires to see what worked. We just had to make do with what we had. So I think I worked on in every single role in the business before we backfilled, and Chris similarly. It's hard. I know a few times during our journey we'd be looking to hire for these sort of half roles. And I've seen a lot of startups do similar things because that's all you can afford, and you need someone who can do, two sort of wildly different things. It's very hard getting that person, and you struggle to get the right person and then to get them to stay. But it's something you work through, and you when you have to, needs must.
Yeah, nice. Now, you mentioned before you've got to grow and learn, right? You're obviously technical to start with. I believe you did a university degree as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that growth and learn from, not the technical side, but what did that look like for you? Are you looking at external partners to come in? Are you looking at coaching? Are you looking at mentoring? Are you looking at a mix of, are you looking at MBAs? Like, what's your experience? Let's start what your experience was and then advice for others.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of resources out there. For me, the most valuable things I found was, one, having, people talk about a growth mindset, but effectively being open to self-improvement, being self-critical. I mean, you can only, there's a great saying, you measure yourself against yourself yesterday, improve on yourself. Don't look to others and compare. But being able to be self-reflective, think about things afterwards, change how you'd approach that in the future. I think is a important skill. Mentors are critical, both from just being a sounding board, someone who's been through this in one way, shape, or form, who can you can relate to, and of course someone who can just who can give you advice. Mentors, I find, have a shelf life in that you really want the right mentor for the right time in where you are with your journey, and then you know, find another one. Push yourself. Not that you can't have multiple mentors or one for a long time, but I find in particular that mentors hold up a mirror on the particular challenges you're facing right now and help you work through those. Having mentors tailored to that helps a lot. I did have executive coaching later on once we had bit of free cash flow to be able to spend on those sorts of things, and again I found that incredibly beneficial. Whether I'd get the same out of it earlier in my career, I don't know, probably not. I think I was definitely in a place where I was ready and willing to get those additional tools and take it even further. So I think those three things, at the end of the day, it comes down to you, your own harshest critic, surrounding yourself with the right people, mentors, coaches, whatever it is, but being able to self-reflect, take in feedback and grow from there. It's the most important thing.
Mate, you mentioned self-reflect. Other people externally looking in. Startup founder, successful exit, you know, your happy days, right? That's the ideal plan for everyone. Mate, I imagine there was some down periods during that time, and I think it's something that's often overlooked. That it's a grind. It's tough. You're going to have some tough days. Mate, is there one big mistake or big thing that happened that really influenced the way that you went forward? So a big change. It might have been a mistake, or might have been an issue that came up, or something that helped you know you have a change of mindset, or something that you could really learn from in going forward. Was there like any one big issue? Was it like obviously there's multiple things that come up across that journey, but is there a big learning along that way?
Like you say, there's always ups and downs. It's such a roller coaster. In fact, your founders become so good at regulating their emotions. After we'd exited, the deal was done, everything was done. I felt nothing but numbness for a week or so, and not a good numb or anything. Just didn't know how to feel, because I had to, I guess, deconstruct all these mental frameworks in terms of, you know, the lows are so low, the highs are so high, you can't follow those or you'll become an emotional wreck.
Yeah.
So you teach yourself to really dampen down those emotions for better or worse. And after it was all done, some unpicking I had to do there. So in terms of learnings, so many learnings. Definitely one of the biggest one was around staff. Yeah, as you scale, you get past the 20 odd staff, you become no longer a small business. You can't sort of fire people that aren't working at will. You have to very carefully manage the recruitment process and the probation period, because toxic staff can really, really kill an organization. And there was definitely, I'm not going to go into details, but around disruptive staff members and how much damage they can cause was definitely an eye-opening experience for me. So certainly, at the end of the day, it's a people business software. Certainly it's tech involved, but at least for now, until AI takes over, people are required to build it, maintain it, sell it, manage it. So it's a people business we're in.
It's also built for people, right? It's built for customers. It's the same with, I think, even if AI, when AI continues to take over, essentially, you might be building a tool, or the AI is building a solution for a customer, right? Yep. There's a need at the end of it. It's still people oriented. Like all of tech is still people. The Absolutely. Technology is, you know, is a tool. Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. So having the right, like any organization or any team or any endeavor with a group of people working together, that just reinforced to me how critical it is at all levels to manage that effectively.
Cool. And reverse back a little bit. Don't get too high on the highs. Don't get too low on the lows, right? Mental resilience through there.
Mm.
Was that something you specifically focused on? Was that something you're conscious of? How am I improving my mental resilience? How am I not getting too high on the lows? How am I not getting too low on the lows, high on the highs? How do I smooth that out? Is that something you consciously worked on? Is that something you just dull the emotion? How did that come about?
Yeah, I think that was just a natural outcome for me. I didn't consciously work on managing emotions. It was just, it's something that over many years, I mean, I'd had a couple, like I said, smaller startups with web and mobile development in the before Port. And so I'd been through a bit of a roller coaster there, and certainly picked up some, I guess, some ways of looking at things to help manage that. Look, everyone's different. I don't know if I have, if I can provide any relatable advice around that.
No, it's just an interesting space. I think, there's obviously a massive rise in meditation and journaling and things like that at the moment. Wim Hof's gone through the roof in his popularity and all that. I think everyone's dealing with things in a different way, but it's something I think more people are becoming conscious of.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing, is to be conscious of it and then find what works for you.
Yeah.
And it works. I don't meditate daily. I don't meditate frequently at all.
Yeah.
I do enjoy it when I do it, but it's not a tool I need to manage certain things. But for other people, it's something that, is part of their daily routine, and that's fantastic.
So it sounds like just being conscious of your emotions through that period was probably the tool that you used, just being conscious of it, conscious that I'm not riding a high too high, or, I'm going through a low. Like, let's...
Yeah. Yeah, you become a bit dull to it all after so many years, desensitized. That's it. After so many years of some big wins and then big losses, and life goes on.
Oh, I like it, mate. Mate, plays in another part, and I'm getting away from tech now, but I'm getting the stuff that really interests me. I'm asking you the problems that I'm dealing with, right?
Sure.
I feel like if I have a look at health, family, and business as three different buckets, I feel like I only personally ever do two of three well.
Yeah,
if I go all in on my business and still trying to spend time with my family, my health tends to fail. If I'm going all in on business, long lunches and all the rest of it, health, becomes second priority. Yep. All in on that, less time with the family. Those three buckets. Now, if you have a look at if those three buckets for you, how did you manage balance? Or is there no such thing going through a startup journey like that?
I don't think there is.
Yeah.
James, I really don't. It's a great concept, and it's fantastic to be aware of. So that you can address any major issues, family or health or the business before they come up. But it's so all consuming driving a startup or leading a company of any size. 60, 80 hours a week, and you've got no time left for
anything. Necessary as well, right? Yeah. I feel like hustle culture was there for, 5 years ago, right? I think hustle culture was the big thing. Gary Vaynerchuk was a big, proponent of hustle culture, and then he got hammered for it, and he tried to reverse back and give more, context around it. But I think that hustle culture on going in, doing the 60, 80 hours a week sometimes, it's actually necessary to get something off the ground or to get something through a really tough stage. And if you want that perfect work-life balance, maybe a startup venture isn't for you,
or to run
your own journey.
Yeah, I think that's it. If you need the perfect balance, go get a job and draw a salary. If you're going to drive something to any sort of success, unless you're supremely lucky with right place, right time, it'll require a lot of work and a lot of time.
Yeah. And do you think the key is, obviously, you can go, I find this myself, I can go hard for a period of time, and then you've just got to pull back, and that's where you notice, maybe my health's falling a little bit too much, or I'm not spending enough time with my family, or those relationships. It might not even be family for some people, but just relationships outside of work.
Yeah.
Just being conscious of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's similar to how I managed through it. I mean, I've got an amazing wife who helped with the kids incredibly and the home. I had a co-CEO, which was also incredibly, incredibly great from a sharing the burden perspective, if nothing else, apart from the fact Chris is brilliant. Sharing the burden mentally and emotionally was important, but certainly it was all consuming, and then, like you say, you'd sort of blink and come up for air and try and fix a few other things in your life or get them spinning again, spinning tops, spinning plates, before getting sucked back in. I don't think, at least in my experience and everyone I've spoken to and worked with, there's not not much room for balance at that end.
Yeah, and but I'll continue for my opinion on it as well. Like, balance is maybe not a priority if that's your end goal. Like, if your end goal is a successful startup and an exit there, you don't get through that through balance. But not having balance is okay because that's your goal. That's your singular goal and that's your focus for that period of time. And it's not going to be here forever. You can't run like that for 30 years, right? You burn out or other thing, negative implications will happen.
Yep.
But for a period of time, that's your singular goal and you're all in on it.
Absolutely. Eyes wide open.
Yeah, I like it. There's all in, dumb all in, where you're spending all your time on stuff that's not overly productive. There's obviously a heap of different productivity tools out there and things like that that can make life more efficient these days. Is there something or any tools or methodologies that you use to help make yourself more productive through those really busy times?
I used to be a big tool junkie.
Yeah.
I used to love tools. I still do. I love a good tool. I mean, nowadays it's in my garage with mechanical tools everywhere. But I've set up so many project management systems and different methodologies I've both studied and been accredited in. There's a lot out there and there's a lot that works really well. And obviously it's very contextually relevant. Big construction projects, you want something regimented like Project. MS Project to help manage all of the different streams there. In terms of personal productivity, I find, again, it depends on context, and this is sounding a lot like GTD getting things done, but for me, it's a lot of email, it's a lot of phone calls, it's a lot of conversations, chat messages coming through, and I found Microsoft To Do, or was it Wunderlist or something before then? Todoist is another one.
Yeah.
Really simple, basic, where I can set just number one thing is to get it out of your head for personal productivity, get it into a list. If you need to put some labels or things on it to contextualize things, great. But for me, the big things are date, due date, drop dead due date, and priority or not, start or not.
Yeah.
And it's that simple. And so every Monday, I'll usually do a big scan of the coming week in terms of both calendar and personal tasks I need to do. I'll set up sort of theme days maybe where I can focus on different things, or if I'm at a certain place, I can accomplish some certain tasks. And then each day you check in and you work through it. And there's all those tips out there, which, do work wonders, get good sleep, get up early. I find a good hour or so in the morning, early morning, before anyone's gotten up, before any of my staff were online. So precious. I could get so much done just getting into it there. That's personal productivity. Obviously, for teams, it's very different depending on the discipline, whether a service delivery team or a tech team, you've got different tools and approaches.
But. Yeah, mate, I'm always interested in the personal side of things. I think if you get that part right, then, managing a team and that can be easier. But, hey, if you're trying to manage a team, you're trying to get that right while also not having your own ducks in a row, I think can be a recipe for disaster.
Yep.
Mate, one final question before we work into, where you're at the moment. But, mate, if you somebody starting out, aspiring technologist, maybe wants to grow their own company or move up the ranks within one company into more of a CEO, CTO, right, and a senior management, so pure technology role growth, whether it be in a startup or internally within the company, any advice for them?
Look, the soft skills, interpersonal skills, and being able to marry a deep technical understanding of the ecosystem or your company's product set with the interpersonal skills. So being able to explain to people why we should or shouldn't do things and convince them of that, not just based on pure technical logic, which often most people won't get, but tying it into strategic objectives and business outcomes, very valuable. Very valuable. And at the end of the day, your upper management is all focused on the key numbers that the board sets. And if you can demonstrate yourself or an agenda you have being able to align to those, then that's going to get noticed.
And that's really interesting, actually, especially for a pure technologist, understanding what you're building, who you're building for, why you're building it, how that aligns to the company goals.
Yeah.
I think it's something that's sometimes overlook. Like, I'm building a really quality piece of software. I'm writing really clean code. But, like, what are we building? What is the product that we're building? It might be, like, a product company. It might be a product within, you know, a bigger company, like you're building something. Like, understanding what the higher-ups are actually trying to achieve, because, you know, your boss or your boss's boss is going to have objectives that are very often not how clean is the code, but, you know, what are you building, who are you building it for, how's that creating efficiencies, profit, whatever it might be.
Yeah, yeah, look, it opens your eyes to the bigger picture, and how you take, you know, how you can leverage that is then, of course, up to you. Lots of people.
No, I think that there's never too early to start to really understand that. I think that's a really good piece of advice. Period of numbness you mentioned. That was a little while ago now, but, you know, what are you doing with yourself at the moment?
So I sit on a couple boards, the Hunter Angels, which is a local group of local membership based organisation of high net worths that invest into startups in the area and across Australia. I've just joined the board recently, a few months ago, the foundation, HMRI Foundation.
Yeah.
And so HMRI, the Hunter Medical Research Institute, for those that don't know, up at the John Hunter there, does some amazing world-leading medical research in a number of areas. Fantastic organization. We should be so proud to have them in the Hunter, have that in the Hunter. So my role there is to help with fundraising events, and to also work with the team in terms of commercialization of IP, some advice on how maybe some IP could be spun out and commercialized from the organization. So that's quite exciting. I've recently stepped onto the Northern New South Wales Regional Advisory Group for AICD, the Australian Institute of Company Directors. So the AICD, again, is an industry group that really focuses on education for company directors. They have a course, the AICD Directors Course, which is fantastic. Teaches a lot, governance, risk, strategy. Being a director or operating in the director role is very different from an executive. So it certainly takes some time to think like that, learn to think like that. And certainly I'd advise any founder who's operating as an executive and either sitting on a board or reporting into a board to consider that course, or at least look at some education in that area. If and when the time is right, obviously early on, it's lower priority than building a product and getting sales. But as you start to deal with VCs and independent directors, etc., equipping yourself with those skills, as well as understanding the liability you have under Australian law as a director, is a significant amount of personal liability you take on.
Yeah,
and everybody should understand that. So. Yeah, those are keeping me busy at the moment. I also advise and consult with some local startups and scale-ups, helping out in terms of growth and business strategy there. Lots of interesting things happening in the Hunter at the moment. So yeah, keeping me busy. As far as getting in touch, LinkedIn is probably the best. Reach out there.
No worries, we'll link that up in our show notes as well.
Awesome.
Appreciate it, man. Thanks for your time today. Really interesting, again, to hear somebody who's gone on that successful journey to exit. I think that is the holy grail for a lot of startup founders and technology professionals that go out on their own. So hearing your journey and a couple of those learnings along the way is super interesting, hopefully helpful for some of our listeners.
Awesome, mate. Appreciate the invite.
Cheers, man.
Cheers.